This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Will democracy advance the peace process in the Middle East? Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Palestinians are scheduled to go to the polls next month, but Israel threatens not to allow any voting in East Jerusalem. Israel's own election is scheduled for March, and it's likely to be affected by the results from the occupied territories. On To The Point, we'll hear about the growing strength of Hamas, the Palestinian group committed to Israel's destruction. What about the health of Ariel Sharon, his one-man party, and the new leaders of Likud and Labor? On Reporter's Notebook later on, Big Brother comes to Britain's roads and highways with every license plate on every vehicle recorded for 5 years. First, here's the news.
Support for To The Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To The Point. Palestinians and Israelis both face elections in weeks to come, and both sides are divided among themselves. On To The Point, we'll talk about politics in the occupied territories and in Israel, where Ariel Sharon is being challenged from both the left and the right. On Reporter's Notebook, Britain has plans to record every license plate on every vehicle on all its roads every day. We'll ask about technology and civil liberties. First, this news update. As he flew into Baghdad for a surprise visit today, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld hinted that the U.S. will begin a modest reduction of troops in Iraq in hopes that Iraq's new leaders will, as he put it, pull that country together toward the center and not pull it apart. Jonathan Broder is defense and foreign policy editor for Congressional Quarterly. And Jonathan, always good to have you on our program.
Nice to see you, Warren.
Associated Press says this was a hint from the secretary. He then is quoted as saying that until it's announced, no decision is ever final. But it does appear, I take it, that this has been in the works for a long time.
Yeah, both the administration and military leaders have been also hinting that there is going to be some sort of a drawdown of troops in 2006. And I think the timing of this announcement by Rumsfeld, he's over in Iraq to visit the troops on Christmas, is, you know, pardon the expression, but he's sort of throwing out throwing the troops and the families a bone, hinting at a timely moment, and a meaningful moment when families, you know, think about others in their family that these troops might be coming home. But as Rumsfeld said, the president is leaving himself the option to reverse such a decision just in case the situation on the ground deteriorates.
On the other hand, you'd assume that he wouldn't create this expectation if there wasn't a pretty certain intention of bringing troops home.
I agree. I think that, you know, there's a large political element to this as well, back home, a domestic political element. 2006, of course, is the year of midterm elections, and many members of Congress who up until now have been sort of a rubber stamp for Bush on his policies in Iraq are beginning to push back. There are a number of examples of this that we've seen just in recent weeks. In the defense authorization bill, there's a provision in there that requires the president to report to Congress quarterly, every 3 months, to give lawmakers a written report on economic, political, and military progress in Iraq. Of course, there was the amendment, the John McCain amendment, banning the use of torture, which one could interpret as a statement on Bush's stewardship of that war. So there is concern in the administration that this year, 2006, has to be a year where progress has to be made in Iraq, and the best way to show that progress is by bringing out troops.
The secretary himself, as I indicated, said that there is the hope here that whoever takes over the government will bring the country together rather than pulling it apart, reference no doubt to what's apparently the result of the election, which is that a Shiite, a conservative, or religious-oriented government is very likely to form up there. What about the Iraqi security situation then, and how is it that the United States can talk about troop withdrawals when it would appear that perhaps the Iraqis aren't ready?
Well, there's two things going on here. The Americans are saying that, you know, as the Iraqis stand up, we'll stand down, and the numbers of Iraqi troops that have been trained are sufficient for at least some troops to begin to come home. The problem here, as I see it, is not so much the numbers of Iraqi troops that have been trained, which is what the administration is emphasizing. It's the loyalty and the sense of identity that those troops have. Many of these troops belong to militias. The Kurds have their Peshmerga militia, which is considered part of the new Iraqi army. The Shia have two of their own armed militias, and they are also counted as among these Iraqi troops that whose numbers the administration is mentioning. The question is whether they feel an overarching identity beyond their ethnic and sectarian identities toward the Iraqi state, and that remains to be seen.
What about those people here? You mentioned the politics of all of this. There's people here in this country, including many people in the Pentagon, John McCain, John Kerry during the campaign, who said, we don't have enough troops there to begin with. We ought to have more.
Well, you're not hearing that very much anymore. I think that everyone realizes, even those who, like Kerry and McCain, who have called for more troops, that there's really no possibility of more troops going over, particularly in this midterm election year. So what you're seeing is a greater emphasis on the number of Iraqi troops that are trained, those troops would take the place of the Americans as they leave. But I think as a political issue, that has become a non-starter.
Again, though, the issue then, as you pointed out, with the Iraqi troops is, what is their loyalty? Are they going to be fighting on behalf of the new central government, or are they going to be more sectarian than one might hope under these circumstances that Secretary Rumsfeld might hope, according to what he said today? As always, Jonathan Broder, thanks a lot for being with us.
My pleasure.
Defense and Foreign Policy Editor for Congressional Quarterly. In a moment, will democracy advance the peace process in the Middle East? On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warman Alney back with To the Point. There was more violence today in the Middle East. After three militants were killed by Israel, a Palestinian rocket was followed by Israeli artillery fire. Meantime, politics on both sides are increasingly complicated. In last week's local Palestinian elections, Hamas demonstrated its growing strength by winning in several cities, including Nablus, the biggest town in the West Bank. Next month, parliamentary elections are scheduled, the first since 1996, but the rise of Hamas has put them in jeopardy. Greg Myrie reports from Jerusalem for the New York Times. Greg, good to have you back.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Hamas is very popular because it is seen to be corruption-free, in contrast to Fatah and the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It also supplies a great deal of basic services in the form of charities. What's the problem with Hamas as far as Israel and the United States are concerned?
Well, they say Hamas is a terrorist group, and Hamas has been behind many of the suicide bombings here, and they don't want Hamas to participate in the election, at least as long as it's continuing to promote its militant policies and call for the destruction of Israel.
So what has Israel said, then, about the upcoming elections, particularly in East Jerusalem?
East Jerusalem has been a sensitive time every time the Palestinian elections have come up, and Israel is saying they're opposed to Palestinians voting in East Jerusalem if Hamas participates in the elections, which it looks like it certainly will do.
So what happens then if, in fact, Hamas is participating? What's Israel proposing to do about it?
Well, they're saying that the Palestinians in East Jerusalem will not be able to vote. There's about 200,000 Palestinians in East Jerusalem, so it's a pretty sizable percentage, close to 10% perhaps of the Palestinian eligible voters. They have been allowed to vote in East Jerusalem before. Israel is threatening to bar them from doing so this time. They could travel a few miles and vote in other cities in the West Bank, such as Ramallah, but the Palestinians are saying this is unacceptable. They've been allowed to vote there before. It was part of a peace agreement in the 90s. They should be allowed to do so again. But Israel says because Hamas is participating, calling for the destruction of Israel, this is not a legitimate democratic process, and therefore they're going to revoke that right to vote there.
What kind of pressure does all of this put on Mahmoud Abbas, the current leader of the Palestinian in the Palestinian territories, and of course a member of Fatah and the Palestinian Liberation Organization?
He's in a very awkward position because he's seen as being weak and has not been able to advance a lot of the things he wants to do, not been able to get full-scale peace negotiations with Israel going. So this could make him look even weaker in a lot of ways. If he caves in to what Israel says, that there'll be no voting in East Jerusalem, he'll look weak on that front. If he postpones the elections, that's also going to look bad. Hamas and other Palestinians are not going to go along with that very easily. These elections are long overdue. The last parliamentary elections were in 96, so it's been almost a decade. They were planned for July, but Abbas postponed them till January. So he's in a tough position here if he can't bring about Palestinian voting in Jerusalem and keep the elections on track at the same time.
Both parties in Congress, or excuse me, both houses of Congress, I should say, by very large nonpartisan votes, urged President Bush today to make clear to the Palestinians that if Hamas is participating, it could jeopardize the United States' assistance to the Palestinian Authority. How important is that?
Well, very important, and again, another big problem for Mahmoud Abbas. The Palestinians are heavily, almost entirely dependent on foreign aid to run their budget. Their economy really has collapsed during the past 5 years of fighting. The U.S. assistance through various means is quite considerable. It's in the $100, $200 million a year. The EU has also hinted at a similar thing, that if Hamas participates in the elections, joins the government, and plays a prominent role in the government, that aid to the Palestinian Authority would have to be reconsidered. So, again, it puts Abbas and all the Palestinians, perhaps, in somewhat an awkward position. If Hamas participates in democratic elections, and if they do well, it might bring about a reduction in aid to the Palestinians.
Greg Myrie, Jerusalem correspondent for The New York Times. Let's get a Palestinian voice into this conversation. Daoud Kutab is director of the Institute of Modern Media at Al-Quds University, also runs an internet radio station in Amman, Jordan. Mr. Kutab, welcome back to you.
Thank you.
Tell us about this now from a Palestinian point of view. We've heard how much pressure there is on Mahmoud Abbas, how Hamas is growing in power and strength amongst Palestinians. What do you think is likely to happen?
Well, I don't think it's very likely that the Palestinians would ban Hamas from participating. Hamas is an integral part of the Palestinian community. They are part of the Palestinian movement in general, and no sane Palestinian leader would ever ban them from participating. So they have to participate. I think there is a little bit of a missed opportunity here, because the Americans, who've basically supported and allowed Islamic groups like Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt to participate, Hezbollah, which is considered a terrorist organization by the U.S., is part of the Lebanese government. You have Islamic groups in Iraq who are participating. So to single out the Palestinians and to say, you know, Hamas should not participate sounds very unusual. And I think there is a double standard here. I think Palestinians cannot deny them from participating. If the U.S. Is going to threaten withholding funds, I think this will not be a good idea, because it's going to push Palestinians more and more to the military option. And I think the Israelis are also paying close attention to what the Americans are saying. Mr. Sharon was in the U.S. last autumn, and he tried to convince Mr. Bush that to ban Hamas, and Mr. Bush said no. And at that time, the Israelis retracted and said, okay, Hamas can participate. So I think they're having hesitation on this, and they're looking at the U.S. Congress as kind of giving them support to their opinions.
So in other words, then, you think that there is, by virtue of what the Congress has said just this week, some significant chance that the United States will withdraw its support of the Palestinians?
I think the U.S. and maybe also Europe are trying to have it both ways. They want democracy in the Middle East, but they want their tailor-made democracy. They want democracy in their own way. They are clearly worried because Hamas did well in the last municipal elections about the possibility of Hamas doing well in the legislative elections. I don't think that they will win outright, but yes, they will do well. But I think the Americans and the Europeans can make the same mistake they did in Algiers when they tried to stop the Islamists from winning there, and there was a huge mess there. I think they should stay away from interfering in the internal politics of people and let them choose who they want. I think it's reasonable for the Americans to say, okay, we want somebody who, you know, who's going to be moderate to a certain degree, but they cannot interfere any more than that.
Dawood Kutab, again, director of the Institute of Modern Media at Al-Quds University. Robert Malley is director of the Middle East Program at the International Crisis Group. That's a non-governmental organization in Washington. He's also been part of the diplomatic corps from time to time. Robert Malley, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What are the prospects here for the United States withdrawing support from Palestinians if, as Dawood Kutab tells us, it would not be sane for any Palestinian leader to try to ban Hamas from the political process?
Well, I think a few points have to be made. The first is that Hamas exists and will be powerful whether or not it participates in the elections, whether or not it does well in the elections, and whether or not it joins the government. I think, as Dawood Kutab just said, it's a reality, a Palestinian reality, and the elections, it will reflect their power. They won't create it. So the focus on elections, I think, is misplaced. For the United States to start making threats of cutting aid, in my view, at this point, is either feckless or, at worst, it could be counterproductive. Feckless because it's not going to have an impact on how Palestinians vote. They're not going to vote against Hamas because they fear a cutoff in aid. That might be true if they felt that the aid that they had gotten while Hamas was not participating in elections had translated in real improvements in their daily lives. But that's not the case. So it really sounds to them as a hollow threat when you tell them that in the future you're not going to get the aid that didn't really help you, at least as they see it, in the past. And second of all, Palestinians, like people around the world, don't only give in to threats of economic hardship. They have other issues on their mind, dignity, their own pride and their own political convictions, their own ideology. And again, threats of economic hardship are not going to make them switch their votes. So at this point, I think all that kind of discourse is not going to help the self-professed goal of the Congress, which is, and of Israel, which is to reduce Hamas's power. I think the better option is to wait and see what happens. If Hamas, in fact, assumes positions of power and responsibility, at that point, one has to see what kind of policies Hamas does engage in. Does it continue with attacks on Israelis, or does it not? And that should shape the policy that the United States, the European Union, and others decide to adopt vis-a-vis the Palestinians.
Are the United States and Europe, as Dawood Kutab suggested earlier, guilty of a double standard when they have tolerated Hezbollah, the Muslim Brotherhood, but not Hamas?
Well, the real tension is between saying, on the one hand, that they want democracy and that democracy, in fact, has become one of the principal driving forces, rhetorical driving forces, of the U.S. administration, but also not accepting results of democratic elections if they bring to power or if they give power to groups that we are hostile to. Once we've made democracy this priority that we've set for the Middle East, we're going to have to come to terms with the fact that at this point, at least, democratic elections are going to bring to power many groups, whether it's in Egypt, whether it's in Iran, in Iraq, among the Palestinians or elsewhere, that are hostile to U.S. policies. That's a reality we're going to have to contend with, but it's a gamble the U.S. appears to have taken, and it can't short-circuit it in mid-course.
Right. So that, Robert Malley with the Middle East Program at the International Crisis Group. Now, time now for an Israeli voice in this conversation. Dr. Mordechai Hadar is Middle East expert at the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies at Bar Ilan University in Israel. And Dr. Hadar, welcome to you.
Hi. How are you?
Good, thank you. What we're hearing from Robert Malley and from Daoud Kutab is that it is only realistic to assume that Hamas will be a powerful force, whether or not it is allowed to participate in the election. So why not allow it to participate?
Well, the problem with Hamas is not that it's a political party which is religious. I myself, as a religious Jew, I back every religious man who wants to create a political party and to run to parliament. This is okay with us. The only problem is that this political party has weapons and uses those weapons in our buses, in our hotels, in our streets. This is on one side. And the ideology of this political party is that Israel as a state has no right to exist. So what prospects can we expect from such a party once it gets to lead the Palestinian, let's say, future state? How can you manage any kind of policy with somebody who looks at you as somebody who has no right to exist? So it is some kind of a mine which you are going to step on it no matter what way you go. So why allow this party with the weapons which it already has and with the ideology which denies the right of Israel to exist? How can Israel allow such a thing? Even in democracy, democratic way to the power, and don't forget that democratic process brought some kind of very unpleasant regime to the power in Germany in 1933, and we are not willing to repeat this scenario.
What do you think that Ariel Sharon will do if, in fact, Hamas does appear to be part of the electoral process next month in the territories?
I think that this scenario will play to the interests of Sharon, because once Hamas will take over, even become, let's say, a powerful entity inside the Palestinian Authority, this will ease on Sharon everything which he would do to the Palestinians, because all the world will support the Israeli fight against this entity, and we saw it already in Algeria after 1992, the elections where the Islamists got in power in Algeria, and all the world backed the army when the army turned the whole thing around. Only because Europe, mainly, and America as well, are not supportive of Islamic, let's say, fanatic gangs get into power nowhere in the world. Now, and what Daoud Kutab tried to compare between the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and in the Palestinian Authority, this is not the reality, because those Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt have, first of all, no weapons. Secondly, they are not saying that the Mubarak has no right to live as a regime, while Hamas is totally different from this point of view. This is why there is no way to compare between the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt and Hamas in the Palestinian Authority.
All right. We need to go to a break, which we will do. We'll come back, talk with our current guests and one more as well, as we discuss what's going on in the Middle East politically. Dr. Mordechai Hadar, our most recent speaker at the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies in Israel. On Reporter's Notebook, Britain will be recording every car on every one of its roads every day. We'll talk about crime fighting and civil liberties. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warman Ali back with To the Point, talking today about the extraordinary complexity of establishing a democracy in the Palestinian territories and of the consequences in Israel. We'll talk for a moment about how complex the Israeli political situation is. First, I want to go back to Robert Malley, director of the Middle East Program at the International Crisis Group. We just heard from Dr. Hadar, who says he is an observant religious a Jew, very concerned, obviously, about the about Hamas and its intention to destroy the Israeli state, or its insistence that the Israeli state has no right to exist, and says that will play into the hands of Israel Sharon if Hamas becomes a part of the process in the Palestinian territories. Your comment, if you will.
Well, first, I think it's fair to say that Hamas does present a problem, and obviously to the Israelis who had to suffer a number of Hamas attacks. So I have no problem and no question about that. But there are a few points, again, that need to be made. The first, I'd like to shoot down this Algeria myth, which has been raised several times. In Algeria, the Islamist organization was on the verge of a landslide, an electoral landslide. That's not what we're talking about here. Hamas, in most of the projections, is thought to perhaps gain 20-30% of the seats, perhaps a little more, but they will not be in a position to govern the Palestinians or to make the laws. So we're talking about something different, and we're talking about what Mahmoud Abbas wants to do, which is to try to see whether by bringing Hamas in at least in the parliament, he can subject them to the laws of the institution that they will have joined. That's his gamble. It may or may not work. But the real question to ask is, what are the options, what are the alternatives of those who don't want Hamas to participate? I understand Hamas is a problem, but how do people assume they're going to deal with Hamas? Hamas has not been in government and has not participated for the last 10 years. That certainly has not dealt with the problem. The problem exists. Mahmoud Abbas has an idea, has a plan, and at this point, given Palestinian politics, I don't know that there's any better alternative than to try to bring them in and see whether by bringing in, by having responsibility to take care of their constituents, to have to bring real improvements in the Palestinians' livelihood, it might not moderate their policies. I think that's a test that they're going to have to pass.
Robert Malley, I know it's been you've gone to some trouble to be on our program today, and we appreciate it very much. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Director of the Middle East Program at the International Crisis Group. Also listening to this conversation is Yossi Alfer. He's co-editor of bitterlemons.org. That's an Israeli-Palestinian internet-based dialogue. Formerly was director of the Jaffe Center for Strategic Studies at Tel Aviv University. Yossi Alfer, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Let's, if we can, set up the political situation in Israel with elections now scheduled for March. Ariel Sharon, who just had a stroke, went into the hospital, having set up a new third party, being challenged by both the Likud and Labor, it would appear. How strong is he?
Warren, before I get to Sharon, as you said, I've been listening patiently. And I would just like to add one comment on what has been said.
Of course. We wanted to come back to all the issues we've talked about.
And put it in a broader context. American democratic reform policy in the Arab world is enfranchising armed Islamic groups in Iraq, in Lebanon, and soon in Palestine as well. You have to look at this in the broader context of American policy because the United States encouraged Mahmoud Abbas to bring Hamas into the fold. And we're talking about an armed Islamic group. It's not just terrorists. It's not just that it doesn't recognize Israel, but bringing in Islamists with their own private armies into Arab governments is hardly a formula for democracy, and it certainly is not going to contribute to stability and to the course of Arab-Israel peace. Now, turning to Sharon, it's quite surprising that despite the mild stroke he had, and in an almost counterintuitive way, his party, Kadima, has actually gone up in the polls by three or four or five mandates, obviously, primarily at the expense of Labor, it appears, because Likud, which has finally chosen a new leader, Benjamin Netanyahu, is able to present a more orderly face to the public and is beginning to recover a few of its votes. But whether the voters are going to reconsider Sharon's health sometime in the course of the next 100 days before elections and think about the fact that he has in effect formed a one-man party or a party that's controlled by one man and reconsider this is not clear, but at least for the moment they have not.
Tell us about Labor, which has new leadership also.
Well, Labor has a Amir Peretz, who, upon taking over Labor, the party rocketed up by almost 50% in the polls, but it has been descending ever since, and apparently the polls that are going to be published in tomorrow's papers take it way back down to around 19 mandates from a high of 28 or 29. Peretz is very much a dove on the peace process issues, and also very much the, let's say, traditional labor leader, and he it seeks to present to the public an integrated strategy, which basically says that the reason for impoverishment of the lower socioeconomic classes and the reason for the huge gaps between the rich and the poor in Israel, the biggest in the Western world, is in fact the absence of peace and a peace process. At this point, it doesn't look like he's succeeding in selling this, even though his very dynamic leadership has brought some new blood into the Labor Party. Again, 100 days is a long time in which things can change, but it seems to me that if Peretz doesn't adjust his positions on the peace process and perhaps opt more to put top priority on additional unilateral withdrawals, he may continue to lose popularity.
If, in fact, Hamas does appear to continue to be playing a role in the Palestinian side, do you agree with what we heard earlier from Dr. Kadar that will be favorable in a way for Ariel Sharon?
Yes, I do. It will be favorable for anyone who basically doesn't want to get into a peace process with the Palestinians and claims that we don't have a partner. This will be a self-fulfilling prophecy to the extent that Hamas does well enough in elections, and I don't agree here with Rob Mali. There are many Palestinian, moderate Palestinians who are worried today that Hamas will get more votes than Fatah. It will be the biggest party, and it will certainly be able to exercise influence, radicalizing influence, extremist influence, on the positions the Palestinians take vis-a-vis Israel. And this will give even Amir Peretz, I dare say, will have to reconsider his offer to recommence the negotiations unconditionally with the PLO, because it won't be the PLO. It will be a PLO that is 40 or 50% Hamas.
Let me go back to Daoud Kutab, our Palestinian, again at the Institute for Modern Media at Al-Quds University. Mr. Kutab, you've been listening carefully to what we've heard from Robert Malley and from our Israeli guests as well. Does Mahmoud Abbas have any prospect of disarming Hamas?
You know, it's taken the IRA and the Irish a long time to disarm the IRA. I don't think it's going to happen overnight, certainly with the, until the political and military process is de-escalated. I think the issue here is exactly what Robert said, is for years and years people have been encouraging the Palestinians to try to bring in the Hamas. Even Shimon Peres has always said, use the ballots, not the bullets. And I think bringing them in is a way to kind of disarm them. I don't know that it's a conditional way, but I think the more that they are participating in the political process, the more it will be easier to try to get them to stop their attacks or to limit their attacks to more defensive, which is what they're saying they need the arms for.
Do you think that they will be able, if they do participate, to get, as Robert Malley said, 20 or 30% of the vote, or that there's a possibility, as Yossi Alfer insists, that they might actually be a majority?
I don't think that they will be a majority, but I do agree that the more the Americans, the Israelis, and the Europeans don't want them, there is a kind of a boomerang reaction. People say, okay, if people don't want them, we're going to vote for them. So, to a certain degree, they're playing right into their hands, and I think they'll do well, but I don't think they will have more than a third of the vote, which is a strong representation. But once they are participating in the political process, I think they will be less tempted to take the military option and try to find a political answer to the conflict.
Dr. Mordechai Kadar, let me go back to you at the Begin Sadat Center. What do you say to that, that in fact the continued opposition to Hamas, particularly by the United States and Europe, in addition to the parties in Israel, could have a boomerang effect and be counterproductive?
Sure, I do agree with this, because this is how things are here in the Middle East. But I don't agree with Daoud Kutab about the percentage of Hamas, because What we saw in the local authorities elections last weeks, that the Hamas had, you know, like 90% or 80% of the local authorities with the vast majority, especially in Gaza Strip. And what I see, the process is definitely going to lead to a situation where Hamas is leading the Gaza Strip, while the West Bank is led by Fatah. And if I read well what Sharon wants, is he wants to divide between these two parts of the Palestinian Authority. And I think that the outcome will be Hamastan in Gaza and Fatahistan in the West Bank. And this will put an end to the dreams of having one consolidated Palestinian state. And this, again, will play to the hands of Sharon.
Daoud Kutab, that prospect, what do you say to it?
Well, first of all, we should not take too much in the local elections. People do want corruption-free local leaders. Hamas has always worked on the local front. On the national level, on the political level, people understand that the Palestinian-Israeli conflict has to be resolved with the help of the international community, with some moderate forces, the way we saw Mahmoud Abbas win so well in the elections. So I don't think people will give the same vote for a national elections as they would for local elections.
Okay.
So I don't think that's... But whether Gaza will be more Hamas-supported, you know, a conflict always supports the radicals, and when there's a lot of violence, when there's the economic siege and so on, that plays into the hands of the radicals. I think what we need to all work on is trying to ease the economic siege on Gaza. We need to allow people to have a participatory process in political elections, and I think that will bring in the moderates. It's going to take time, and I think, unfortunately, Mr. Sharon has not been helping the moderates. Since the election of Mr. Abbas, there hasn't been much help in supporting the central elements, the moderate elements in the Palestinians, and that's played into the hands of Hamas. So, you know, I think the Israelis themselves have done that, whether because they are interested in it or because they didn't have the courage to really do some drastic things to support moderate elements like Mahmoud Abbas.
All right, I'm going to interrupt you in the interest of time because I want to get one more comment from Yossi Alfer before we have to leave this subject. Again, co-editor of bitterlemons.org and formerly with the Jaffe Center in Tel Aviv. What about this issue raised earlier about a double standard? From the United States point of view, if in fact we are supporting democracy, how can we then say to the Palestinians that if, as you yourself indicated, they want Hamas to lead them, that's not a democratic result we like, and we're going to withdraw support?
Well, as I said earlier, the United States is supporting democracy, but a very strange variety of democracy in which it's encouraging not only Islamists to participate, which is fine. The example of the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt is a good one. They're not armed and they're not terrorists. But it's also encouraging Islamic movements with private armies to join and not to get rid of their armies. And Hamas is making it perfectly clear that once it's elected and it's part of the Palestinian parliament, it does not intend to disarm. So yes,
but if that's who the Palestinians want, that's democracy, isn't it?
Well, to your question, if the United States is saying we disapprove of an armed Hamas running, but it's perfectly all right for Musa Sadr's people in Iraq, and it's perfectly okay for Hezbollah in Lebanon, then yes, it is a double standard. But let's assume that the United States ceases the double standard and encourages Mr. Sharon to allow Hamas to participate in the elections, which is probably the only way to go, including in Jerusalem. We Israelis will then be perfectly justified in refusing to talk to the PLO afterward. From Sharon to Yossi Beilin, all the way on the left, Israelis are united on this issue, that once Hamas, an armed Hamas that refuses to recognize Israel, that continues terrorism, is part of the Palestinian polity, it's a very different polity. And the end result will be, hopefully, under these conditions, that the next Israeli government will opt for more unilateral measures, completing the fence and unilateral disengagement, this will at least keep the two-state solution alive as an option, looking toward a time when we encounter a Palestinian polity that is not so armed and dangerous.
Greg Gamirri of the New York Times, Jerusalem correspondent, is still listening here. We have about 30 seconds left, and I'm sorry, that's all we have. But what do you foresee in the next few weeks?
Well, they're going to have to resolve this issue about whether or not the Palestinians are going forward with the election. I think they will. I think they will come under a lot of pressure from the United States and from Palestinians themselves, ordinary citizens who want the election. I think Israel will come under a lot of pressure to let the Palestinians vote in East Jerusalem. So I would say those are the most likely ways we would see this play out. And we will see an election, and the results will be very interesting.
Thank you all very much for being with us. While the U.S. is embroiled in disputes about domestic surveillance of telephones and computers, Britain is about to become the first country in the world where the movements of all vehicles on the roads are recorded. What about civil liberties? More about that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're only back with Reporter's Notebook on To the Point. Britain already has thousands of closed-circuit TV cameras all over the country. Now they're being converted to read the license plate of every passing vehicle on every main road and highway, as well as in towns, cities, ports, and gasoline stations. A central database will store 35 million license plate reads every day, increasing to 100 million a day in the future. That's according to Steve Connor, science editor of The Independent. Steve, thanks for joining us.
Hi.
This is extraordinary from a technological standpoint. I take it that the authorities there are convinced they can do it.
They are indeed. The technology has taken some 25 years to develop. It's been refined. It's been made more accurate. And it's obviously a lot cheaper than it was when it was first anticipated. But more importantly, the political will now is there as well, because in addition to catching criminals, it will also help in the fight against terrorism.
So it has many purposes then. As far as ordinary crime is concerned, is the major focus organized crime? Is it speeding and drunk driving and crimes of that kind? How broad is the sweep?
The main focus is to target the 2-3% of vehicles in Britain which are of interest to the police. These are vehicles which are committing fairly minor offences like unlicensed, uninsured, or without a valid test certificate. But the police are also interested in the same group of vehicles, because obviously criminals don't tend to insure their vehicles. They don't tend to buy the road tax disc, etc. So if they can target these vehicles, they're also pretty convinced that they can target criminals as they go about using the road network. So the primary aim of the project is to actually drive criminals off the roads. But a secondary aim is to build up this intelligence data bank of vehicle movements, which can be stored for between 2 and 5 years. And you'll then be able to mine the information using sophisticated software to see how a vehicle has moved around the country over a period of months or years, and indeed what other vehicles it may have moved with in terms of convoys. This would give the security services and special branch a better insight into some aspects of surveillance and intelligence gathering.
Again, Steve Connor is science editor for the Independent newspaper. When you say that it'll be mined, who's going to do the mining? You say the security services. Is that everybody from local police to the foreign intelligence agencies?
The database will be kept in London in a secure installation next to our police national computer. Every police force in Britain will have access to the database through secure terminals, and they will use it for their own crime-fighting purposes. But in addition to that, the security services at our MI5 have access to this sort of information for purposes of national security. And in fact, they're exempt from all data protection legislation when they do that that task for which they're charged.
You say that because of terrorism, there's now the political will to do this. Will that political will continue, do you think, if the main people who are picked up as a result of all of this are people who are unlicensed or uninsured or haven't paid their tax?
Well, if people who are not licensed, who are not insured, are taken off the roads, then the vast majority of people, the 97% of people who do pay their tax, do pay their insurance, will be much happier because, you know, these people are forcing up the cost of their motoring. And I think many people will see it as a positive development. But, of course, you know, it all comes down to whether it's being used for benevolent or malevolent purposes. And at present, it's obviously being sold to the public as being an operation which will help law-abiding citizens. But, of course, you know, you can envisage a day when maybe a more malevolent regime comes into power and abuses that system and actually... for actually tracking people which they, for one reason or other, are particularly interested in tracking.
So are there then civil libertarians who are complaining about big brotherism?
Well, the situation is such that in Britain we are probably the most intensively surveilled society probably in the world. There's more street cameras and on street corners and roads than you'd ever see in a typical American city. I mean, I drive into London from a small town outside London, and I pass literally dozens and dozens of cameras on the way into work. And many of those cameras will now be converted to read my number plate, my license plate, automatically. And my movements every day will be logged and recorded on this computer. Now, am I worried about that? I'm not worried about it if it is for crime prevention, because, you know, I'm not a career criminal. If it was being used for other purposes to target a journalist which people, you know, are not particularly happy with, then obviously I wouldn't be happy with that.
So, again, Steve Connor is science editor for The Independent. There are abuses. What abuses are possible other than targeting journalists that you don't like?
If we take the Police National Computer, for example, this is supposedly a secure database of... names and of people of interest to the police and of car registration numbers and registered keepers, etc. Now, that database is supposed to be secure. It is supposed to be for police purposes. It is supposed to be for fighting crime. But there have been cases in the past over the years of that information being sold on to third parties, to private detectives, etc. I mean, that's one possible area of abuse. Now, one would hope that the police are keeping this information extremely secure and for purposes for which it is intended for, which is for fighting crime and for combating terrorism.
You could, though, theoretically, I take it, if you had a political enemy, for example, trace that person and that person's movements over a long period of time if the data is going to be held for 5 years.
Yes, you certainly can envisage, you know, a situation whereby political activists of one color or another could be targeted and could be tracked. But you'd also hope that the security services would be prevented from doing that on a whim, and that they would only target people who were of a genuine threat to national security. And you know, there are, as we know, quite a few people living in Britain whose clear intention is to kill and maim as many other British citizens as possible.
A little more about the technology involved. Obviously, there would be miles of videotape as a result of all of this. What do we know, I should say, about the technology that would allow at some point in the future a search, a mine, as you put it, that would turn up the and allow the tracing of just one license plate out of all of those miles of videotape?
Well, in fact, there won't be miles of videotape. It'll all be digital. The cameras themselves are cameras which are ordinary digital video cameras. They are fitted with software which enables them to look for a number plate, a registration plate, a license plate, as you call it, and are able to identify that license plate and to decode it. They can do something like 3,000 license plates an hour. It's very accurate. It's not something like 98% accurate. It can be done night and day using infrared cameras. It can be done in low light conditions. They're now very, very accurate cameras. The information is then transmitted via a secure police communications network to the central computer, which will take basically the time, the date, and the place of each license plate and store that on its database. So presumably what would happen is if a police officer wants to see which cars were on this particular part of the motorway on this particular day of the year, they would put in the coordinates for that part, for that particular road, and they'd come back with all the license plates that have passed that particular camera at that particular time. Another way of searching it would be to put in the license plate and say, right, let's see where that car has been in the period January to February on such and such a year, just to see where that person has been.
All right. Once again, the nation just described as the most surveilled in the world, about to become even more surveilled. Steve Connor, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Science editor for the Independent newspaper in London. Today's program produced by Ileana Justice with Jonah King and Francis Anderton, technical director Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.